Attention, please. Attention, please.
I'm about to take that.
I can deal with this trouble, friends, with a wave of my hand. No, we're not doing the Music Man this morning. We are talking about Jesus of Nazareth, Jewish teacher, healer, and prophet. Those aren't his years that he lived, obviously, but that's the years of his ministry, as we might call it. So, welcome to this new venue. Sorry if you can't all find a place to sit. But just remember, I'm not sitting either, so. this just gives me a little more room to pace, which I like to do. So I kind of like it. I'm going to scoop up, kind of take command of the stage here. I don't necessarily need this today. I figured since it was here, it will help sum up where we've been. I wanted to share a couple things. You know, the whole point of doing this, of course, is not just a historical exercise. I mean, there are two kinds of ethics, two kinds of theology. One is descriptive, where you describe what a person taught or what a person thought, and the other is the fancy word for it. It's called normative, which means that you're saying what should we take into the present, and how should it shape our own moral vision. And so we've been doing mostly this describing, which is, a good place to start. As I said in the first session, if we want to know what Jesus would do, it's helpful to know what he did do. And so that's kind of the thrust of things. But I wanted to, one of the things that's nice about Holden is getting away from it all, but, now that there's, Wi-Fi, it's kind of hard to completely do it. And it's always a little depressing to find to see the news, but, well, first, I guess I'll just point this one out. One of the issues, of course, that we're dealing with as a nation, let me back up and say, so the normative point is how as Christians should Jesus shape our approach to some of the moral issues of our time, which are very pressing and certainly very relevant to, what Jesus taught is certainly connected to it in some way. So, for example, the issue of immigration, right? I mean, that is a huge issue right now, and there's the human propensity for, I don't know if it's for othering, is there a better word for that, for making someone into an other, is just so deep-rooted, and it's coming out in spades. And this is just a Christian Century that I just found on the stand over there in the library. It just has a nice kind of overview of churches and immigration law. I hate to say this, but or tell this story in some ways, but I missed the boat. I took the train from St. Paul, and all the way we were like right on the bubble in terms of whether we'd catch the bus that goes from Wenatchee to, we were supposed to get in five. We were two hours and change behind. So we were on the bubble, and we ended up missing that bus. You know what it's like to get here. The bus from Wenatchee to Chelan. We missed the $1.50 bus and ended up having to take an $85 cab ride, which luckily I could share with Tom over there, whom I met on the train. And you didn't hear this, Tom, because you were in the back seat, or maybe you did, but I was just saying, so what's the population of Wenatchee to the driver? And he said, well, it's 80,000 if you count the illegals, or the immigrants. I think he said immigrants, but he said it with a little bit. And I said, "Well, do they work? Are they migrants? Do they work the apple orchards and stuff?" And, no, they take any job they can get. It was just this derisive, clearly, again, othering. These are and probably to some extent, it's not for nothing, is it, that this is coming out during the time of economic distress. That we need. I mean, we look at the way this has played out in other cultures and other times in history, and we say, "Oh, we'd never be like that." But it comes out. I mean, of course, you think of World War II and in our country. I mean, what we did to Japanese Americans, and it's there, and the scary part is, polls show, I think, that about 60% of Americans think what the Arizona law is just fine. And two-thirds of Arizonans think it's just fine. And you know, most of us don't live in that border, and it's easy to stand and judge. Although in Minnesota, we've got this new driver's license. There's all kinds of stuff bubbling now about let's get those illegals out of here, as they're taking our jobs. But 2/3 of Arizonans apparently support this. Guess how many? Guess what the Latino population is in terms of percent? 1/3. So you can kind of probably see that. Anyway, justice. I mean, what's just? What's right? And how can Christians even begin to feel hostile? I can see where a Christian perspective might lead one to say, we need a law about this. We need some. I mean, we need some policy that is. But it needs to be. But it can't come out of just a sense of get them out of here because they're the cause of the problem. It's really hard to see that. The other one, and this one applies more to the topic we're going to get to today, and that is some of you may have seen this, but the Supreme Court just ruled on another Second Amendment case, the right to bear arms, which I claim when I was warming up. waka waka. But this is a sort of an extension of the ruling that they did, was it two years ago, basically saying that the constitutional right to bear arms, which of course is that famously vague phrase, but on the surface of it seems to have been motivated by and referred to a militia that would be able to respond to another tyrannical government, actually applies to all individuals on a federal level, so that states and cities cannot any longer have their own ordinances that that infringe on that right. So we better lock and load. I think pick up a gun in Wenatchee on your way home. To those who would prey on the citizens, this was the ruling came as a response to a law. The challenge was to a law in Chicago. The city ordinance that I don't know the exact details, some of you maybe do, but one of the plaintiffs said, to those who would prey on the citizens of Chicago, to the criminals, I would like to say the Chicago crime buffet is over. We are not prey. I mean, it's not funny. So why are you laughing? it isn't. It just boggles the mind when you consider the number of people who consider themselves Christian, that they would so facilely. I mean, I don't want to just take a completely knee-jerk reaction to this, but that there wouldn't be some reflection about, or that it would be seen to be in line with one's faith to have this approach, is difficult.
But we should be up in arms.
Who said that? That's good. I like that. Oh yeah. Anyway, so and then obviously tomorrow we're going to be talking about sex, violence today, sex tomorrow. I know you're really sorry, Paul. But same with sexuality is also a huge issue in our culture right now, right? Obviously the homosexuality issue, but that's going on right now too. The Proposition 8 case. I don't think they've rendered they've wrapped it up, but I don't think they've rendered there was a challenge to the Prop 8 in California that of course is only going to be a first step, but it'd be really interesting to see which way that goes. Anyway, just a sense that it's helpful to have some of these issues in our purview as we look at what Jesus did in his context, right? So what did Jesus do in his context? Well, we spent the first two sessions, those of you who were there, kind of mostly setting up that context, and then yesterday got into some of the ways in which Jesus butted against it. But just to this is, some of you saw this the other day, but this is kind of one of my favorite ways to kind of reorient our sense of what Jesus was about. Not, again, to take away, I don't know if it's going to work, to take away this Jesus who's so comforting and to many of us, and what a friend we have in Jesus and all that stuff, but But to recognize that if that's our sole image of Jesus, our understanding is deficient. And that, you know, I always point to the fact that there are four Gospels that differ greatly. You know, no one image is meant to be the predominant one. And so I like to sort of morph this Jesus into a reconstruction of a first century Jewish male that was done a number of years ago. And this is what you get when you what Jesus much more likely would have looked like. It probably would have been about 5'6" or so. Not, I mean, relatively speaking, that he wouldn't. But it's rather different. And what this and it helps us again see that Jesus was a first century person who addressed the situation of his time. And we characterize that with these three phrases of that I borrow from Marcus Bohr, that was a politics of domination, an economics of exploitation, and a religion of legitimation. And within that context, Jesus came with a program. The idea is that Jesus didn't just come to preach otherworldly salvation. He came to address particular needs of the time. And I couldn't make Alan's Bible study this morning, but I hear that's part of what he talked about too. That Jesus' teachings were directed towards, you know, people in their concrete reality, and not just. About not just to say, believe in me and you'll go to heaven. We did talk yesterday. My picture of Jesus as a first century person is one who formed a movement, you know, called followers to live in a community that reflected the kingdom or reign of God on earth. And we talked last night about how Jesus really had a prophetic consciousness, that he drew a sense of justice from the prophets, and set that over against any type of ritual or sacrificial service, beautiful songs, all that wonderful quote from Amos, set that over against if your community is not practicing justice, I don't want to hear the noise. You know, all of your wonderful songs and your worship is just so much noise to me. It makes me want to puke because it's completely out of whack. Now, don't take from this that Jesus was anti-ritual per se. I mean, one of the great quotes is when he says, you know, when he's attacking the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, he says, "You tithe mint and cumin and dill and just a little bit of oregano." and offer these great things, you should have done, but practice justice, mercy, and love along with them. So he's not like, you know, abolish ritual, abolish worship. And in the Sermon on the Mount, he says to the person, if you're going to give your gift to the altar, and someone has something against you, you know. So let's not misinterpret Jesus as being anti-ritual. It's just that there has to be a harmony between the way we worship and the way our society is structured. That's the love of God and love of neighbor, and that's the Good Samaritan. That's why it's such a great parable. Now the central idea that Jesus within which Jesus framed his ethical teachings. You know, I think he took his consciousness from the prophets and some of his passion for justice, but the real centerpiece of his teaching was the reign of God. Mm-hmm. I prefer the word reign of God over kingdom of God, because kingdom of God, just what do we think of first when we think of the kingdom of God? Well, we think of king, right? Right. And where do we think of it?
Heaven.
Yeah, it's synonymous for a lot of us with heaven. And that's not what Jesus meant by it. Jesus meant, it's certainly not exclusively. Kingdom of God is not about going to heaven or how you're going to get to heaven. The kingdom of God, and I like that you said that it suggests a king, because that's traditional kind of top-down authority, which we're going to see, and as you know, Jesus eschewed and spit out. But the reign of God could be both basically defined, it's the place and time where God's rule, God's values, I guess, kingdom values actually manifest themselves. And that's what Jesus tried to set up. If you think of what's Jesus, you know, the Lord's Prayer, right? What's the central petition? Your kingdom come. Not may we get into your kingdom, but your kingdom come. And then how is that described further? Your will be done on earth as in heaven, right? So it's about setting up, not a utopia, but setting up the values of God on earth. So that's if you look at the Sermon on the Mount, which we'll be touching on some, obviously, but and I would love to do a session just on the Sermon on the Mount, but the way it's structured is that the Lord's Prayer is in the center, and this is in the center of the Lord's Prayer. So it's and that's what, you know, I think what Daniel, I just saw him locked in, was after too, when he talked about, that's where he got the name Manna and Mercy, as I understand it. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, and it's manna and mercy. So the Lord's Prayer is central to that whole thing. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as in heaven. That's what Jesus was, I mean, that's, you know, and this is not a religious program. This is a, you know, it's a, kingdom is a political word, right? It's not just a religious word. And it had a political dimension. So God's will be done on earth, and not whose? Caesar. Yeah, the power is at work. Caesar. So you can also see that this is part of his seditiousness. Is that he was claiming allegiance to a higher authority that transcended and actually stood, you know, in judgment of the other powers on earth. So, what did this program look like? We want to get to the issue of nonviolence, or violence, obviously. And if we don't, please don't throw anything at me. but let me just run through. I kind of see four dimensions of Jesus, four markers, I guess, of Jesus' kingdom vision, his moral vision, put in terms of the kingdom or the reign of God. And these are going to sound very familiar. There won't be anything new. But I think it's just helpful to see them kind of laid out and to see the coherence of Jesus' vision. We tend to kind of see individual teachings. And sometimes we just focus on, well, that, you know, on that one teaching. I'm doing Vespers tonight. That's what I'm going to talk about. I think it's just these high demands. What are we supposed to do with them, right? But Jesus really did present a coherent vision of what he saw as God's characteristics of God's reign. First characteristic: deliverance of poor and the powerless from injustice. That's Luke 4. We just touched on that last night, where Jesus stands up, and this is his inaugural sermon in Luke, and says, you know, the kingdom of God. He says that, you know, the Spirit of God has come upon me, and this is what it's commissioning me to do. He has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, sent me to proclaim release to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And that year of the Lord's favor, what's that called again? Yeah, the Jubilee year, which is the year, well, that's a long history in and of itself, but invoking it, here, in sort of an eschatological way, in an ultimate way, it's all about balancing things, reversing things. Slaves will go free. It's the 49th or 50th year. This would happen. It's actually out of Leviticus. Deliverance, so that and debts would be forgiven and so forth. We should try introducing this into our legislature. But. Yeah, right, exactly. And we know the crippling power of debt and how it really is a dead end for an oppressive thing. It's very different for us, obviously, than, I don't mean to suggest that that our situation is like the first century. Debt there is very different, as we'll see. But that was, I mean, that's the basis of his mission, according to Luke, is that he's there to deliver the poor and powerless from injustice. Luke develops that theme so beautifully from the very beginning, from choosing Mary, or from focusing on Mary for the birth story instead of Joseph, which Matthew does, and the angel and the shepherds and the manger and all that stuff is in Luke, and of course Mary's beautiful song. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty and thrown the powerful from their thrones and all that stuff. Again, nothing new there, I'm sure. But here's a really interesting one, and difficult one. As one of the things we struggle with is church structure. But one of the things of Jesus, that is, I think, a mark of Jesus' reign, is a redefinition of power. One of the clearest places where that comes, and to use a word that John Dominic Crossan uses, he says that Jesus had a brokerless kingdom. That is to say, there weren't intermediaries. There was no hierarchy. It was egalitarian. And lest that sound like just us imposing modern cool ideas on it. It's right there. The Gospel of Mark, I think, is especially powerful in developing the theme of power as service, right? Power. I mean, who else could have more power than the Son of God? But what Jesus on earth, but what Jesus is saying is that to be God's in the kingdom of God here on earth, the community that we're forming, it is to serve. And the stories that reflect this. Mark's central section from 8 to 10 have these three stories. Three times Jesus talks about what's going to happen to him. He's going to suffer and die. And the disciples, of course, totally misunderstand him. And my favorite one is the last one when James and John. Is that the lesson? It was a lesson recently. And of course, Alan talked about that in opening Vespers this week. But James, in a different context, when they asked, fire to come down. That was such a great use of that text. But James and John, one of the stories is they're arguing about who's the greatest. Jesus is just talking, and then he takes a little child, right? James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came forward and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you." And what do they want? To sit in his right vision and left side. Yeah, they want power. Exactly. Because the disciples are thinking in terms of in human conceptions of power. And once they come to figure out that Jesus is the Messiah, in that great passage in the middle of Mark where Jesus asks, "Who do people say, who do you say that I am? You are the Messiah." And he orders them to tell no one about it. Why? Well, because they have a total misconception of what it means to be the Messiah, right? Now Jesus is trying to drive that point home. And so you have them constantly showing their misunderstanding, and this is sort of the climax of that. They want to sit on his right and left hand. It's always a little bit. I always get a kick out of the fact that Matthew, Mark is the harshest on the disciples, right? If you know the Gospels, Mark is the one who the disciples can't do anything right, and they don't get anything. They don't understand who Jesus is first, and then they don't understand when they come to understand that they don't understand what it means. But Matthew wants to. Matthew is much more interested in the church and church structure. To be honest, he's the one who has the "Blessed are you, Simon." Barjona, I will give you the keys. You are the rock, and on this rock, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom and all that stuff. But in this scene, instead of James and John coming up to Jesus, how it goes. It's the exact same scene. It's Matthew's version of it, but it's their mother. Their mother comes up to Jesus and said, "Will you do this for my son?" It takes a little bit of the, but Mark is just mom. but clearly this really is the climax of this misunderstanding and these Jesus' famous words. You know that among the Gentiles those whom they recognize as their rulers lord it over them, and their great ones are tyrants over them. That's how the world understands power. Power to say, you do this, I can, you know, I tell you to do something, you do it. Right? That's power. But it is not so among you, but whoever wishes to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first of all, first among you must be slave of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Right? So it's Jesus' own. Jesus is not the king. I mean, he's the king, but he's a king in a very different sense. Right? Again, nothing probably very new there, but just a very central piece of Jesus' teaching. Any questions or comments on Jesus? Yeah.
Back to the Lord's Prayer. Do you know historically if there was ever consideration of using your reign come in a newer translation?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it could be. It
makes such a huge difference if you really change that.
We already have so many versions.
Yeah,
to introduce another one might be too much, but I agree totally. It evokes a whole different thing. And something that we say over and over, it's really helpful to have it, you know, jar and be a little bit different, sort of like the picture of Jesus. Restoration of outcasts, excluded women. Jesus was, we didn't spend any time on this because we know that this is part of Jesus' ministry. But again, I hope it helps to flesh it out a little bit when we're looking at it in light of the context and how jarringly different Jesus' way of being was than that of the surrounding country, culture. He challenged the holiness system of the temple, those who were excluded by it. His view of holiness, you know, the view of holiness of the temple establishment was that if I were, you know, if I were a priest on the way and one of you was unclean somehow and I touched you, that would render me unclean. If you were a leper or something like that. Jesus reversed that and said that you are, oh shoot, I need to go on. But Jesus reversed that and holiness flowed the other direction. I think it's a great image for that. So that touching him made him holy, brought him into community, and so on. So, not a very concrete teaching. Now, so it said that Jesus was a revolutionary. All of these things we could flesh out but I want to get to the balance question. The question is, okay, by what means are we going to bring about this this revolution? Because he was not the only one talking about revolution, right? I mean, except for those at the very top of that pyramid who had things, you know, pretty nice, everyone else was, you know, this isn't right, this isn't right. We've got to do something about it, or God has to do something about it. And Jesus' vision, too. Jesus' vision, he was not just sort of hanging out doing it. This is hard to say unequivocally or with great clarity, but there was certainly a transformative dimension to his. He was not just teaching whoever would listen. He was trying to establish something, a community. I just have to share one of my favorite marks of both of these things. His idea of community is one of my favorite passages comes from Mark, where Peter says, you know, hey, Peter began to say to him, look, Jesus, we've left everything and followed you. You know, and here we are just wandering in the desert. Jesus said, truly I tell you, there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for my sake and for the sake of the gospel, which is what they've all done, right? Who will not receive 100-fold now in this age. Houses, brothers and sisters, mothers and children, and fields with persecution. With persecutions. persecutions. And in the age to come, eternal life. So this is a community he's establishing. And notice one of the things that is just, you know, when someone pointed it out to me, and I just, whoa, notice what's missing from the second list. Truly I tell you, there's no one who has left houses or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or fields for my sake who will not receive a hundredfold houses, brothers and sisters, mothers and children, and fields. What's the missing?
Honors.
Right. This is another sign of Jesus' egalitarian community. In a patriarchal culture, the father was the one, you know what the father was like. So this is the kind of place that Jesus was trying to establish. And so how is he doing it? I would just submit that he's doing it without violence. There are, of course, some people who would like to point to certain passages and say that it is not unequivocal. I just think we can look at those, but I want to develop the idea for the rest of the time here that Jesus was an essential aspect of Jesus' program was to bring this revolution about in nonviolent means. So, questions or anything so far? I think that's kind of about it for this. I think I'll just turn it off. So, probably the most infamous and difficult passage for Christians in general, but also one that goes right to this violence question is of course this, the one from the Sermon on the Mount, right? You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to anyone who begs, everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. This is always pointed, or often pointed to, as one of the verses that just suggests, where does this guy come from that he thinks that we could live like this, to shape a community around this? This is just completely ridiculous. How is this verse usually taken? What does Jesus seem to be saying here on the surface?
Submission.
Right. Submit. What else? That's a good word. Submit to what?
Violence.
Yeah, to violence, to evil. Someone does something against you, and
you accept
it. You know? What else? What are some other words? So submit. Accept evil. Mm-hmm.
Passivism.
Yeah, passivism. That's
two S's.
Right. yes, exactly. That's a good. So passivism. Pacifism is it's a stance, right? It's a stance towards violence and war. But what it often is equated with, as these guys are saying, is passivism, which I don't know if it's a word. It's a problem with boards. They don't get one of those squiggly lines that says, this isn't a word. that's somebody should be inventive. Actually, it's kind of nice. You can make up words without them. But pacifism is often equated with passive. Yeah, so submission, acceptance of evil, what else? Passivity, I guess, is probably the right word.
Wimpy, a doormat,
great. Yeah, just lie down in the face of evil and take it. Yeah.
I heard somebody interpret this slightly differently.
Yeah, good.
And that was, if you take my cloak, you're responsible for my cold, my nakedness,
right.
And in a sense, you share my shame.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you do that, and so you have to bring that back before sundown, so I have.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, what you're getting at is exactly where I want to go with this. And the person that was usually given credit for looking at this verse completely different is a guy named Walter Wink. He wrote several books, but they're distilled in this one here. I don't remember if this is one that I ordered, that I asked the bookstore to order, but it is a terrific book. The Powers That Be, it's called, by Walter Wink. It's very readable. It's a distillation of three thick volumes, and he puts things so well. Have you been up here? He's in the tradition of like John Howard Yoder and others. But he just he takes this passage completely differently. It says that the church has completely misunderstood what it's saying. First of all, he likes to point out that look at how it's look at how it is formulated. I say to you, if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, and if anyone wants to sue you, in other words, he's addressing people for whom these things would have been very common, right? That they would have experienced this kind of thing in their daily life. This was life for them. So again, this idea that Jesus was just laying down a principle is not adequate, because he's addressing their particular situation. And so the first thing to note is that he says, the translation is, do not resist an evildoer, is wrong. It's misleading. The Greek word is antisthenai, and in almost every other context in which it is used, it doesn't mean, this is the word that's translated here, resist, do not resist evil. But in almost every other context in which it's used, it's always associated with violent resistance, of taking a stand, of taking a physical stand. So a much better translation, he suggests, would be don't react violently against one who is evil. Don't react violently against one who is evil. How does that change things?
You have to react.
Pardon?
You have to react.
Yeah, there's. It doesn't. It's not this. It doesn't say don't react. It says don't react violently. So what's the difference? Well, then again, this is where it's so helpful to remember that our first century context, things would have been experienced very differently. Some of you, you probably had someone demonstrate this too, but it's not accidental that he says, if anyone strikes you on your right cheek, right? I'll take you, because will you come up here, please?
Whoa.
All right, strike me on my right cheek. How are you going to do it? On my right cheek.
Oh.
My right cheek.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But you can't use that hand. That is a dirty, filthy hand.
Oh, no.
Yeah, in the, I mean, we still have, I mean, lefties are still, I mean, that's a long-standing thing. Pardon?
Very sinister.
Yeah, sinister. I mean, it's sinister, it's unclean. In Qumran, the Essenes, if you gesticulated with your left hand, that brought you 10 days in isolation. I mean, it just was seen as a, so you don't, in that culture, you don't use your left hand, and Romans didn't either. I mean, it was, so how are you going to strike me on my right cheek?
I guess what I've got left is this.
Right. Ow! We should have Bob up here. Do that again with some velocity. How's that, Bob?
Yeah.
Not bad. One more time. I like that. Okay, you got it. Now, this is fun, because who slaps someone like that? A backhand. Yeah, you've been through some of this, haven't you? That's right. A superior.
Someone who's higher in the hierarchy. Right.
Someone who's higher in the hierarchy. So he's a Roman, or he's a landowner. I'm a regular day worker or whatever, and I tick him off somehow. It's like that. It's a subservient. It's a insulting as well as
dismissive.
Dismissive. Thank you. Yeah. It's dismissive. So turning my right cheek does what? So if I turn the other cheek, so he's hit me on the right cheek. If I turn the other cheek, What happens?
He has to hit you with his fist.
Right.
Equal.
Right. He has to hit me. He has to. If he's gonna, it's a challenge that's not violent, but I'm reacting by saying, I dare you to treat me like an equal. So here, the point here is what? Of course he might just do it. He might just deck you. Nobody. I mean, this very important thing to say is that this is not a way out. This is not an easy way out, I should say. It's a very risky way out. And so you've got to decide now. you're going to sort of be a little disoriented and say, well, am I going to hit him like he's an equal, or what am I going to do? So, thank you.
I think I'll spare the other cheek for now.
So this is a way of resisting. It's a way of sort of disarming the other person, figuratively, maybe literally, and disrupting the normal order of things, right? Because they would be used to someone just going, you know, like this. But if you stand up and not take it, Gandhi said that nonviolence involves refusal to participate in anything humiliating. That's what it's about. To acquiesce to that by just turning the other cheek in the sense of this is you know roll over me, I'm a doormat, is to acquiesce. But that's not what this is about. So now we're up to this other one that this gentleman has pointed out, which is the do not resist an evildoer. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also a second mile. Again, what's being referred to here in first century Palestine?
Soldiers.
Pardon?
Soldiers.
Right.
Soldiers forcing people to carry their packs. Mm-hmm.
This was a common practice. The best illustration is Simon of Cyrene, who was forced to. He said, "Hey, you there, take this cross." Roman soldiers could do that with their gear. They could, and there was apparently some restriction to that. They couldn't. They could only ask a subject, or whatever you want to call it, to go with them 1 mile. And then so there was some limit to the cruelty they could perpetrate. So what happens? You get to the end of that 1 mile, and you say, "Oh, I'll take it another mile." What is that going to do to the soldier? Yeah, it's going to put him on the spot and say, "Well, wait a minute. I could get in trouble if you do that." And again, it upsets the way things are, in a way that is not vindictive. It's not. You're acknowledging your own humanity. And but yes, risky, of course, risky. And then you've got and if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give you a cloak as well. Sue you. Why would somebody be suing you?
Debt.
Exactly. I get this is the experience of the people Jesus is addressing. But we looked at that pyramid, and one of the things that kept people down here, is debt. The taxes that the Romans would levy on the Jewish leaders would be so heavy, it just got passed right on down. And there was no... there wasn't anyone to regulate interest, so interest rates could be anywhere from 25% to 250%, which again doesn't sound that off from what, but it would be a way of, it's not that different, except it wasn't from overconsumption. That's the huge difference, right? This was a way of those up here eventually taking land to the extent that they had land down here. That's the only way you could pay the debt, is to the parable of the unrighteous steward, the one whose debt was so great that he was going to be sold with his family to meet, and that was the only way to do it. Yeah.
Today, right now, the payday loans are 400% and 500%.
Yeah, that's a great example. The payday loans, that is complete exploitation of people who often people who need it to put food on the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This kind of practice is going on today, for sure. Yeah.
And some of the reverse mortgages for the elderly.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, completely preyed upon. Yes. No, there's some awful stories of vulnerable people being preyed upon by those in a position to do so.
I think it's easy to talk about the other, though, and these kind of things happen to us all the time.
Right.
When someone pulled in front of us at a gas station, should we I think it's easy to look at these and think, well, we wouldn't do it,
right.
But we do it.
Right. example like that, where this gets tricky, and the thing to remember here is that these are response of people down here to people up here. And that's a specific situation. The thing about these examples, let's just finish this to get back to your nakedness. It's a good transition to our talk tomorrow, I guess. I skipped it. If anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, that comes before the going second round. Give your cloak as well. So what does that leave you? Someone takes you to court, and all you have left is your cloak, your coat, and you give it to them, but then you say, you know, so here's my cloak as well. And you're standing there naked. You're standing there naked. And the idea is that it's completely unsettled things. And one of the things that Wing talks about is that in that culture, the shame is more on the one observing the nakedness, right? Not on the one who's naked. Mm-hmm. And there's that Wing talks, I wish Alan were here. Alan's not here, is he? He tells a story about in South Africa I'd like to know if this is a story that's told a lot in South Africa. Some police were going to wipe out this little camp, this illegal settlement, and they said, get out of your houses, and we're gonna level it. And the women stripped naked and stood there, and the police just ran away. Wing's point is, and he's not alone in this, but Wing's point is these are not just pie in the sky, completely unrealistic ways of addressing evil. This is a strategy. It's a strategy of active nonviolence, right? What's the word I'm looking for?
Resistance.
Yeah, nonviolent resistance, right. Which, you know, has been, you know, there are examples of it. And I think I mentioned last night that Gandhi read the Sermon on the Mount and got a lot of his understanding of nonviolence from this as a tactic, not as just a way of being, you know, completely passive.
It seems like all the examples you're giving are examples of using their strategy, their strength against them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going the extra mile is, okay, we're talking about miles?
Right.
Okay, I'll take your mile and I'll double it.
It's taking it to
the face, I'll take striking and take that.
Right. It's taking it all to a ridiculous extreme. Right.
It's jiu-jitsu.
Yep. And the thing is, of course, the other point about this is that this isn't like a list of tactics per se, because it's not going to take long before those in power figure out what you're doing and stop striking on the right cheek or whatever. These are examples. These are examples, and they're creative, and they're kind of funny, and they're I think you know, especially the one where, you know, give him your cloak as well. I mean, Jesus had to say that with a little bit of a twinkle in his eye, and you know, because the picture. Jesus, I would love to do, you know, a whole series on Jesus, as Jesus' sense of humor too, because I think he really had one. I think a lot of his parables and everything. I think I would call it the quest for the hysterical Jesus. That's
yes.
Yes. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
There's also the element of freedom, because these are freely chosen.
Right. You are taking what is possible for you to do.
You're choosing,
right,
to go the second mile.
Right.
You're choosing to,
right,
offer the other cheek.
Right.
So you're, in that sense, you're taking over,
mm-hmm,
power.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah,
I'm thinking from a psychological point of view too, that the whole issue of boundaries,
right,
and assertiveness, as it comes in here, from my being healthy,
mm-hmm,
or enabling someone else to establish a proper boundary. It's kind of what's happening here too, and in some ways,
mm-hmm,
it can be very powerful.
Yeah.
Very powerful.
Right. Because, I mean, we got to remember the ways in which this has been abused. This idea of especially of passivity, that it's been, you know, you've got to take what's going on. You have to remain poor and powerless. You have to remain in an abusive relationship. And you're right. This helps establish a boundary for that. It's none of this is easy. You know what's a lot easier? Right? It's a lot easier and some of you may have served in wars, and I don't mean to say the war is easy, believe me. I just read this latest novel about the Vietnam War, and I watched the Pacific, and nothing but the greatest admiration for any of you who've served. And I don't mean it's easy. I don't mean that. But in terms of a response, most of you probably weren't, if you were there, weren't there because you chose to respond to the situation in this way, right? You know, shock and awe is a lot easier than saying how can, because this takes a lot of creativity. It takes a whole different worldview, and that's what Jesus is trying to inculcate in this community. It's not simply about applying it here and there, or it's about a whole worldview that has to sink in deeply in order that you're not faced with choices like. And people always say, well, what about World War II? And what should we have done to respond to 9/11? These are huge, difficult questions. But there are a lot of Christians who would want to say that Christ offers a way to respond to these things that is neither passive nor violent. There is, and this is what Wynn terms it, there is a third way. Yeah.
I just have I'm just throwing this out there because you were bringing up this notion of shooting someone as a response, and thinking about young people in our culture, that this is not attractive to particularly young urban men without a sense. I mean, how do you make this something that, I mean, within this group, we would probably all say, yes, we get this, but it does not go out of here as an attractive or sexy way to deal with a problem.
Certainly not very masculine in any traditional sense.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's not just the inner city. I mean, it is. I mean, look at our movies.
Right.
We're crying out loud. How many of them, and games? How many of them are about revenge and killing? It's our culture, and we want to have guns. That, you know, there are people meeting in coffee houses, just to, with their guns, just to assert their right. It is so endemic to our culture. So you're right that inner cities are especially difficult places. I mean, in North Minneapolis, for example, we have had the murders this year have been up considerably. And I mean, what would Jesus do? He would join the Lutheran Volunteer Corps. He would start a very small movement within this. You know, he wouldn't. There may be a prong of it that would be policy, certainly, but. But showing that there is another way is because this way isn't even available. It's not that it's not sexy; it's that it's not even available, not even available to be, not even presented as an option.
I think to show that this takes more courage would be a way to make it, because it takes
a lot more courage, and it's in many ways more risky. Mm-hmm.
It also takes a lot of cleverness.
Right.
I mean, you know, the idea
exactly.
is there are really two responses. The response is either to take it or to fight back.
Right. Right.
And finding that third path is hard.
Right.
It's
really
hard.
Right. Right. It is.
How would you deal on a personal level? Say you're an old lady that lives by herself, has a loaded gun by her drawer, or in the drawer. Somebody comes in and is attacking you, and you shoot.
Our time is up. I'm sorry.
Right.
really good example, because often the example that comes back is, you know, what if you're, you know, what if you're, so a robber breaks into your house and is about to, you know, rape your daughter or something, and what do you do? Just, you know, stand, try to think of some creative way and, you know, tell them a joke or something. Do you hear the one about the, or if you have available a violent means of protecting someone else. I mean, that's the first thing that happens, is that this can come into conflict with what command? Huh? Yeah, no, sorry, not kill for sure, absolutely. But with what very positive command that Jesus espoused? Love your neighbor. Is it the most loving thing to do to my neighbor to allow someone to cream him? When I could stop that person. That's, Augustine is credited with the one to sort of formulate things that way. Augustine, and possibly Jesus, to address your question, would say, you know what, if you're committed to nonviolence, it would be better to be the object of violence than to use it to save yourself. I mean, I'm not saying that's right. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say. And I'm not saying that it's right or that you, you know, but...
I wouldn't agree if it was someone breaking in to steal your
belongings. Right.
But okay.
Right. When it's your own...
But it's on your own person. Mm-hmm. I feel like I have a mission here in life.
Right.
And he's taking that away from me.
Right.
So I would be a little bit violent or maybe scared to death.
But the question would be, and this is awful thing to have to debate, but the question would be, is your mission somehow compromised if you kill?
So one way would be, or one thing to do would be to come up with other ways to prevent this from happening.
Yeah.
But that doesn't answer the question directly, but it's...
I think looking
for that third alternative.
I mean, I have to say, a full commitment to nonviolence opens up the possibility that we will die at violent hands.
One of the things about the hypotheticals, we forget about that the other person is a human.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right away you say, a robber that's going to do this and that. I have a friend, Maggie Ferris, and she was on a street corner in Jordan, and someone tackled her into a bush. And he had ill intentions. And immediately she said, oh my gosh, what time is it? I think I missed that bus and my two kids are waiting for me. And she connected for an instant with that person as a human being. He got up and ran away. So it's this, you know, there's a human being on the other side probably too. It may be reachable, may not be reachable.
Right.
One of the interesting modern parables, but it doesn't relate, is the movie Gran Torino.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that. That's a great one.
And it isn't really an answer to that question, but I think it's such a wonderful thing to discuss, because in a way, the Clint Eastwood character finds a third way.
Right, yeah. And another great
violence.
Right, absolutely. And another great example from real life was a few years ago, this in Atlanta, I believe it was, this guy broke free from custody, killed some guards, and carjacked this woman's car, and he ordered her at gunpoint to take him to her apartment, and she started reading Rick Warren's Purpose Driven Life to him. And he gave himself, I mean, he didn't harm her, and he gave himself up, you know? And this was someone who had already just killed, so absolutely. John Howard Yoder has a whole, I believe it's him, who has a book called What If, where he goes through all of these kinds of, and actually later chapter in Wink does too, so if you want to read further about it. Yeah, actually, he's got a chapter called But What If, and it's got situations like this and stories like this, which, of course, are much easier to, you know, to tell than... Dan?
Another Maggie Ferris story. Yeah, she was jogging in Minneapolis towards the evening, and there was only one place where she wouldn't be seen by other people, and the person grabbed her and she looked him right in the face and said, "We're going over to that park bench and we are going to sit down and talk." And a long story, have you heard this one too? Yeah, and make a long story short, they talked and talked, and he shared about his Vietnam experiences. And then she said she was afraid to walk at night, so if he would walk her home, which he did. And then she said the next morning she opened the door and there was a milk bottle out there with a flower in it with a thank you note.
I mean, there are these stories. But
and
let's,
I wanted, oh, just
yeah, go
to
ahead,
add
go ahead.
To that is that we need in the church to tell these stories to each other, number one, and also to practice.
Yep.
You know, the military spent years with a person to teach violence, and we spend no time almost teaching the principles and practicing with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. That is really, really a great point.
Well, I just want to say I give my friend Elaine my permission. If that guy breaks into her house and she's got her gun there and she can't cleverly do one of these other wonderful things you're saying, she has permission to shoot him. And we live in a faith that has forgiveness. So I will accept Luther's command at times or suggestion. You have to sin boldly.
Yeah. Because I think these are great stories and they have to be told. But I would, I mean, percentage-wise, I would say probably, you know, I don't know, one, more often than not, the perpetrator is just going to go through with it anyway. It depends on your commitment, I guess, to this way of life and whether you're, because it is risky. You know, it is. Be interesting to know if there's, I guess we wouldn't know if there are the cases where that didn't work, where somebody tried to humanize the attacker and, you know, he just went ahead anyway. Yeah.
And when we're talking about the hypothetical situations, we're pre-imagining the event of violence, mm-hmm. and we can feel our blood pressure rate going up and our temperature rising. And so we're pre-planning our violent response. And we do have the opportunity as faithful people to walk through those things that we fear in advance and start imagining a different response now.
Yeah, that's a good tag on to Dan's point of that this is a mindset, that this is a way of thinking, and it's often called just peacemaking, as a way of as a third way. Anyway, we're finished. Be happy to.